Hi, I'm Sarah.
Hi, I'm Marys.
And this is Playboy Revisited. This month, we'll be talking about the March 1965 issue of Playboy. We're going to be breaking it down, understanding its importance historically and culturally. And today, we're going to start by talking about race. Before we get into the meat of the episode, I want to start us off with a drink recipe. So if you're not 21, don't drink. But if you're 21 or older and you like drinking, take a second to make yourself a Jose Cuervo margarita. So this drink recipe is from a beautiful advertisement. The tequila margarita is 1.5 ounce of white Cuervo tequila, 1/2 ounce of triple sec, 1 ounce of fresh lemon juice. Shake it with shaved ice and serve in a salt-rimmed glass. So that's what I will be drinking to get through the rest of this episode. In March 1965, for the majority of contributors to this magazine, life was great, the grass was green, everyone was more or less on the same page about the war, and Lyndon Johnson had just been elected president. The biggest threat to white America was a distant, one of the elusive but frightening idea of communism. Women still made cocktails for their husband when he got home from work. The men were expected to be the providers for the family while the women slaved away baking casseroles in the kitchen. According to The Legal Art of Tax Avoidance, which is an article from this issue, a decent livable wage was $10,000 a year, and you could afford to live on $10,000.
Okay, first of all, I want to give, like anybody listen to this, like, the year 2000 and up, or maybe even the 90s, even, but you can't do anything with 10,000 bucks, really. That's how, like, outdated it is. But what I want to talk about, actually, that I forgot all about, or just never thought about, is that back in the day, those were white women in those kitchens. So I know the food was terrible. So could you imagine, like, and that's why I feel like domestic violence was so much worse back then, because the husband comes back after a hard day of work, and his wife, Becky, gave him the worst casserole in his life. There's no seasoning, there's no flavor, there's no soul. There's no sauce, no nothing. So his husband's like, dang it, Becky.
And that explains so much. I've never thought of that before.
Dude, I swear, I've never thought about it either, but I swear to God, I cannot imagine being a man back in the days and just pulling up and Becky with the worst, no seasoning whatsoever. Oh God, I feel bad for those guys now.
But she worked so hard on that potato casserole.
Becky needs to do better.
Well, the good news is that they could live comfortably on $10,000 a year, and yes, most of them did.
Yeah, thankfully they could live on $10,000 a year. That's just that rich privilege, isn't it? You can be bad at things you do and still live comfortably. Yeah, I couldn't live off $10,000 a year, nor did my mother, but my mother makes me good food, though.
I'd like to bet that your mother does not make green bean casserole. I feel like that's not her specialty.
My mother would never even attempt to do something as gross as that. My mother loved me, okay? My mother wanted to give me a good meal, not no potato casserole. I don't even think there's a translation for the word casserole in Spanish. I've never heard of it. I genuinely don't know what a casserole is. Is it like, I don't know what it is. Like, I'm dead serious. I don't know what a casserole is.
It's what you give to people, like, at funerals. That it's funeral food.
Yeah, I've done, like, a lot of, like, work, like, lunches and stuff like that, or, like hot pots or whatever you call them. And then, like, they're like, oh, we all bring food. And then somebody was like, yeah, I'll bring a casserole. I'm like, I'm not going to eat their food. Get that thing away from me.
It's like the Jell-O salad casserole that I made for Thanksgiving this year. Mmm, delightful.
That sounds gross.
Guess those are three skin things. Color.
Those are three things that I never want to hear together.
Anyway, so.
You better hope your husband's living on 10K a year, because, girl.
So yeah, you really have to think white women casserole. You have to think Mad Men when you're thinking about what we're going to dive into now. The British invasion of bands such as the Zombies, the Stones, the Kinks, and of course the Beatles, that was all in full swing. The Beatles had released their first album a year ago, and they continued to dominate top charts ever since. They were infamously more populated than Jesus, and honestly, they did mean more to, like, a lot of kids at the time.
Yeah, I've said it so many times. Jesus never dropped Abbey Road. He ain't even all that. He's not all that.
In the advice column of this issue, Rita Rodin complaining about how his 14-year-old daughter was skipping church to worship the Beatles with a handmade Bible and an altar. And Playboy responded to this with, this too shall pass away, which honestly could only be more ironic if they had said all things must pass. But anyway, I love the Beatles, I'm sorry. The domesticity and appreciation of typical white pop culture is the view of 1965 that the contributors of this magazine are most privy to. So this is like the placated existence of this group of comfortable white men from New York and Chicago and Los Angeles. All of this is in reality contrasted against a much more difficult way of life, that of people of color and especially Black people in the Southern United States at the time. In March 1965, LBJ had only recently signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and this act prohibited, on paper, any discrimination of any kind based on race, color, sex, religion, national origin.
Wait, hold on. What paper did he write that on? Like a rolling paper, and he smoked whatever he was smoking on? Because there's no... That is, he could say what he wants to say, but he wrote that on a smoking paper and just hashed it up, because people are still getting mistreated now. This is him just saying like, yeah, I swear I'm a change, baby, and he just never changes. LBJ was a player. LBJ was a pimp.
LBJ had a huge slong, so LBJ had to be a player. Okay. The fact that we historically know that means that he was a player.
Is there any president with like a micro one?
I don't know, but Taft was like really overweight, so I probably looked smaller.
That's the one I'm gonna relate with. Yeah, Taft is my boy. He's just like me.
Anyway, Civil Rights Act, 1964. Yeah, you're right.
Hold on, what a great transition. So we're done talking about Taft's micro dong. Now back to the Civil Rights Movement.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964, like, it definitely didn't do everything it was supposed to do, didn't do everything it set out to do, but it was a step in the right direction. So,
I don't know what type of step people are taking. They must have been in a wheelchair or something, because these aren't steps.
You're right. A lot of the push, like, specifically of this act, was to mitigate voter suppression based on skin color and have equality there so that you can have equality within the electoral process. But
man, not much has changed. It's still the same.
Yeah. Anyway, even though racial equality was more of a dream than a reality in most places in U.S. at the time, unsurprisingly, the Southern United States had the most holdover from the very recent history of segregation, legal discrimination. One Playboy reader wrote in with her own personal anecdotes on discrimination that she'd experienced as a Black person living in Alabama. And violent acts of racism were basically just a cornerstone of her time there. She says, "As Governor Wallace so aptly demonstrates, I have not evaded the kind of thinking that produces these events." And if you know anything anecdotally about the 1960s, it's not a far stretch to imagine how difficult life would be.
Every time I think about the 60s, there's like two sides, and it's like so black and white, not like literally like the race black and white. It's like anytime I think about what it was for the 60s for most white people, I'm sure a lot of them did have it bad, but for the most part, it's all like these ladies with their big old hair cooking their terrible meals, their husband coming back like on some sitcom type of stuff. And then when I think about like, you know, people of color, it's like quite the opposite. It's like so much worse, and I think that's so sad because it's still kind of like that in a lot of places.
Right. I mean, we have made quite a bit of progress since the early 60s. And these things were like so important at the time of the writing of this magazine. Of course, there's still a lot of social unrest. There's still so many problems. And a lot of those problems are the same. We have not done nearly enough to fix them. But at the time, the civil rights movement produced a lot of positive outcomes. For instance, like the Selma March, which took place like literally a few days after the publication of this issue. It was a response to discrimination, obviously, especially in Southern United States, especially after the Civil Rights Act. It was precipitated by the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson during a peaceful protest. So all of this is sounding a little bit, you know, familiar. But
Wait. People of color dying in a peaceful protest?
You know, shocking, right?
Huh. Where have I heard that before?
Yeah, but the march itself, it did elicit a positive response. It resulted in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So there was a lot of unrest, a lot of movement towards equality, a lot of push for that. And again, even though we haven't had the kind of progress that we want to see, the steps that people of color and their allies were taking at this time really progressed the state of affairs in the late 60s. ultimately, Playboy itself is a reflection of its time, and I'm sure that you'll see, like, the contents of this magazine reflect primarily the white middle-class casserole eaters, but they also have undertones of the race struggles and class struggles, the tension and equality of this time.
I feel like with them, it's like they were aware of, like, the struggles, but they were like, well, best of luck. They were just like, anyway, casserole eating people.
Here's a recipe.
Yeah, what cigarette do you want to smoke today?
I mean, honestly, that is actually probably a great just summary of what it looks like. Like, there are nods to that. There are mentions to specifically the social issue of race equality at the time. But there is a hell of a lot more, hey, buy this cigarette.
Yeah, it was like, dang. I was like, hey, people of color, we see you struggling. Good luck with that. Anyway.
Honestly. So now that we've kind of situated this issue within the confines of its time period, let's just double back for a second and talk a little bit about what Playboy itself is. So I've said it before, I'll say it again. Playboy is so much more than just a leaflet.
It's just boobs.
Pornography.
It's just boobs. That's
no,
all it is.
It is so much more than that. It's honestly a societal staple. And like this issue itself kind of pointing to that, like it's got insights from such names as Vladimir Nabokov, who's the guy who wrote Lolita, J. Paul Getty, who has the museum in Los Angeles.
I definitely want to get advice from a pedophile. I think they have the best advice. I love Lolita. It's my favorite book of all time.
Oh my God, stop, please. And no, it's not advice. He writes a good piece of fiction called The Eye. It's very good.
Oh, he does make good fiction. He made that one book about a grown man with a child. He does make some good fiction.
Listen, his prose is beautiful. So Vladimir Nabokov, J. Paul Getty, Steve Allen, who's like a TV personality, Carol Lindley, she's an actress. And then like the one that I thought was most interesting is Shel Silverstein. So that name might sound familiar because he wrote The Giving Tree and Where the Sidewalk Ends and like all of these books that I loved and read as a kid. But he wrote and he drew for Playboy for like
huge
his entire
contrast.
Life.
On one end, you have the pedophile. And the other guy is a kid, a guy who's going to teach your kids how to read.
Yeah, and there's no overlap, I'm sure.
Exactly.
So yeah, all of these contributors to this magazine, they're all names that you recognize, like they're household names, which just kind of goes to show that this really was a part of regular mainstream society. And I think perhaps like the best example of the mainstream existence and kind of the reach of Playboy is found in this piece of reader mail. So somebody sent in a sermon that had been delivered by this Reverend John R. Graham. And the fact that this dude wrote a sermon and gave a sermon to his congregation about Playboy, that was the whole topic. That in and of itself is just like, hello, like this is a part of existence. We all acknowledge. He does a good job kind of talking about a wide array of like the societal reach of Playboy. But one quote that really stood out to me from this is, Playboy stands as one of the most widely discussed commentaries on our contemporary way of life. It's a sort of Bible, which defines a young man's value, shapes his personality, sets his goals, dictates his choices, and governs his decisions. So, I mean, it basically was a big influence on every aspect of this white young man.
Unironically, that can be really cool. Like, you hang out with your homies, and then you're like, hey, you read this month's Playboy? Yeah, like, you know how, like, they brought up, like, the poor African Americans? Yeah, but did you look at the centerfold though? That's where it's at. But it honestly does seem pretty cool. I feel like it would unite people almost. Like you could talk about one common interest because
yeah, I mean it was definitely very widely reaching. Like he was saying here, it influenced like every aspect of society, basically everything from, you know, what somebody's consuming to what they're becoming, basically. Yeah. All of this being said, it was very important in a lot of aspects of culture. And like another example of that that I kind of like as a side note, this one Rhode Island House representative like wrote in and he was like, hey, you guys like published an article about me and I got elected. I credit Playboy. Thank you. And not that there's anybody like in Rhode Island. So it's not like he like really had to work hard to get a large
vote. He was competing against a dog.
I know, honestly. But Playboy helped him win. So
he was like, I was almost losing to that one dog, but thank you for putting me in an article. Now I won.
According to the Reverend, Playboy advocates individual freedom with a sense of personal moral responsibility. So take a second. This is the most important thing I'm going to say all day. Playboy advocates individual freedom with a sense of personal moral responsibility. And similarly, another reader writes in kind of saying the same thing. Basically, Playboy is the pursuit of enjoyment with an underlying respect for and practice of intellectual responsibility. So on one hand, you have all the fun of like looking at naked women, drinking fine liquor, having the nicest hi-fi and the coolest cars. And then on the other hand, you have all of the responsibility, intellectual, moral responsibility of facing social issues head on in all of the articles and all of the discussions and opinions that they're publishing. So like you've said before, I mean, you've got race issues and you've got titties, but they're in the same place. So the most important thing that we're seeing here is like this Playboy in a crux. It's fun on one side, responsibility on the other side. And we'll come back to this idea of the duality of Playboy again and again and again. And I think that this contrast, this is the most important part of it, because you come for the titties and you stay for the women's rights.
It's honestly a win-win scenario. I can't think of other companies doing these type of things nowadays and like actively doing it. And I bet it was like groundbreaking at the time. Nobody was really like being like, hey, maybe we should stop doing these bad things to these innocent people. But also, if you don't agree with this, then how about a pair of titties? You like those, don't you?
So let's start with the fun stuff. Representing the fun and the flirty side of Playboy is the pictorials, the advertisements. And it's advertising. I really think that Playboy scratched an itch that was unreached prior to this in terms of male consumerism. Because we know, like, women in the 50s and prior, they've always been marketed to, you know, you have to have the nicest new hair stuff, the best new vacuum, you have to have the right coffee, otherwise your husband won't love you,
makeup. Make the perfect casserole. Like the perfect casserole.
Right, you need the best casserole dish. Yeah, so there's been, you know, years and years and years of marketing to women, especially for like luxury goods that they might not necessarily need. But I think, I don't know, I don't have a great understanding of history, but for me, this is kind of the first time that marketing to men, especially about luxury goods that maybe aren't necessities, the first time that that really finds a foothold.
I can't remember any like old ads for like men, like back in the day, like no ads. Now I feel like I see more ads for men than women, to be honest. You've seen those Ford commercials? It make me want to wish I was like a manlier man.
So like examples of how they're marketing to men here are in cars and drinks and Stogues and stereos and suits. So it's all these things that like haven't necessarily been, there hasn't been a big push for before. You know, you might see marketing towards men for like clothes and necessities, but here it's like these luxury goods, these nice sport cars, nice hi-fis. Fueling the power of these advertisements, what puts you in a better mood to purchase some luxury goods than attractive and scantily clad women?
I feel like it would motivate you to like buy these things. If you don't have money, you're like, man, these girls are in here, and then you also have these cars. These girls would like me in this car, so I gotta put in these $10,000 worth and get me a car so I can get me one of these beautiful women here.
You basically just summed up my entire social psychology class. But it is a really intelligent strategy, and the women that they are basically advertising in this issue, they're no joke. The Centerfold, this is actually the first Black Playmate of the Month. Her name is Jennifer Jackson, and she's so pretty. Also, further eye candy, there's a pictorial essay with like screen grabs from this 1964 movie called Fanny Hill, which is basically just like an 18th century porno flick. So it's all these titties popping out of these corsets. It's hot. Also a collection of pictures of the actress Carol Lynley, who's cute, and also the reason that I have to dye my hair now.
And I just want to bring it back to the when you mentioned Fanny Hill. I have never heard of it, so I looked it up just now on Google, and I looked at the some of the art of it, and Jesus Christ, there is a lady on top of a dude who's sitting on his stomach, and she has a leash, and she has been whipping this guy because his bottom looks like a bloodshot eye. And he also has a George Washington haircut, which is crazy.
Oh, absolutely. They like remade this movie like 5 times too. Really? Because everybody loves 18th century nudity.
Yeah, that's crazy. Fanny Hill is a really good name also. But I didn't know like these old men were freaky like that.
What are you talking about? Old white men have always been freaky.
Well, I know like old white men now are freaky, like they, as far as I've known, but like back in the day, they were.
Based on your personal experiences.
Yeah, based on my search history. But like back in the day, Christ. Back in the day, they were freaky too. Man. Dude, these guys, they lived the best life they could ever. I don't think anybody would ever feel. I
You're
don't think
gonna
there
go
was
out
one
and
of
buy
them.
a George Washington wig tonight.
Dude, that is my next kink.
Depop purchase.
Dude, oh my God. That would make me so much better. I'm about to cosplay.
No.
Yo, what if it's like a one night stand, and then you're like, hey, I have this one kink that it just turns me on so much. And then she was like, okay, cool. She was like, yeah, I've done some crazy things. And I'm like, all right, bet. And I just like, I'll come back. And I come out with a George Washington wig. And she's like, not that crazy.
Oh
I
my
am
God.
good.
Stop, you're turning me on.
Oh, when he comes out with the George Washington new wig, I need that. I need me a man like that.
So all of these nudes, all of this, the illustrated imagery in here, all of these beautiful naked women and the ads and the pictures, they all add to the sexual and aesthetic appeal of the magazine. So, in terms of our understanding of Playboy, Reverend Graham, the guy who wrote the sermon earlier, he points out like sports cars, liquor, and hi-fi, girls are just another Playboy accessory. So don't worry, we will definitely talk plenty about this when I do an episode on gender. But for our
Yeah,
understanding
when do
right
we start
now,
talking about the boobs?
we'll get to it.
I was told we were here for boobs. I don't want to hear about human rights. I just want to hear about the boobs.
Well, that takes us to the more important part of Playboy, which again is the intellectual moral responsibility side of Playboy. And so that's of course where we're going to spend most of our time, because we can talk about boobs, but I would recommend that you see them in person because I cannot do them justice in a verbal art form.
Do you think if I could see boobs in person, I would be here right now?
I mean, I know that you don't have a privilege.
Okay, I'm down so bad right now. I'm talking to somebody about Playboy magazines from the 60s just to feel something. I am down so bad.
Well, we'll be talking about boobs later. Don't worry, don't worry. But for today, we're gonna
Oh, thank
focus
you.
primarily on the intellectual side of Playboy. So the contrast between the fun and the responsibility. The responsibility really lends more to be examined here. So I don't wanna deprive you of buying a copy of the March 1965 issue of Playboy for yourself. So go purchase it on eBay and look at some nice titties.
You know what? Actually, I am gonna do that. I'm gonna buy one right now because I want to read this, and I think it's really cool. No way! You said titties, and I was like, I'm gonna buy it. No, it's because like so far from what we've talked about, like they still these social issues we still have on like going on today, and I feel like I want to have something like physical that's from decades back that proves to me that although we have made progress, we haven't made time. Like I think it'd just be like a cool little like piece of history to have,
Oh,
and
absolutely.
you
Thanks
can
for
show off.
like giving the reasoning for me starting this whole podcast in the first place. It's such a piece of history. So much less has changed than we want to have changed.
And
And it's
honestly,
so obvious.
it's not even like it's Playboy's fault that we hadn't. It ain't their fault, but like you could tell, like they wanted things to change and they were progressive about things, which is so cool. I just think it's really cool when like old things like from decades back were progressive because a lot of things back then weren't. So like when I think of people like Bernie Sanders being in rallies and fighting for social justice, I think it's so cool because back then they were the minority. A white person who cares about people of color were the minority back then. And I think it's so cool that like they would not be scared to speak out, such like Playboy. And like now I want to buy it just so I could be like, hey, I see you and I respect you for
Oh my God.
what you did.
Be honest, it's just the
It's literally just for the titties. That's it. I'm trying to justify my purchase here, but I just want some boobs.
So today we're kind of be talking about that intellectual side, not just the titties. And intellectually, like it's this issue itself, it's made up of works of fiction, articles, opinions. And we'll be able to like kind of explore like the responsible, the cerebral side of this beautiful porno rag. And we'll start today by looking at race within the confines of this issue. So as we mentioned off the top, Jim Crow sentiments were alive and well at the time, and the Playboy readers, they weren't unaware of this. The woman from Alabama who wrote in about her own experience with discrimination and Governor Wallace, she is one of the only certifiable voices of color in the pages of this issue. So even though the centerfold Jennifer Jackson is the first Black woman who's Playmate of the Month, her bio definitely written by white male gaze. And the magazine itself doesn't actually give any nods to the fact that she is the first Black centerfold.
Which is kind of nice, I think, in a way. It kind of like normalizes, or it doesn't try to make a big deal out of it. Because I feel like if they try to like make a big deal, it's almost like they're trying to parade her around like she's a trophy. Which she's, I'm sure she's a trophy.
I mean, she is a trophy.
Yeah, I was about to say she's hot as hell, and I bet she's beautiful. But you know, she's just a human, you know. It's not like they'll be like, yo, we got this Black girl right here. I feel like that's so much worse. So for them to just keep it normal, like always, is cool. I do think it sucks a little bit that, you know, how her little bio was written by a white man.
But of course, like, it was. It's yeah, not of surprising. Course, yeah. I feel like the people consuming it mostly were also white men. Yeah.
But if they would have given her like her own like creativity there, like as far as the bio goes, I feel like that would have been so much cooler. Like she could just tell who she is as a person instead of a white man telling her who she is as a person. It would be so funny though, like the white men try to like imitate, like be super stereotypical.
Oh, like we would super not be like talking about how Playboy is okay with race.
Yeah, I know. It would just change everything, right? It would change everything. Like,
yeah, I agree that I agree that it's good that like they don't really shout out the fact that she's the first Black centerfold. Like they certainly aren't saying anything problematic about it. But it's really interesting because it's definitely culturally significant. Like Playboy, again, huge societal staple, had a lot to do with a lot of things at the time. And the fact that they have this representation is great. I mean, especially at the time. But it's it's interesting. They don't really talk about it. They don't really talk about it, like, even when you're looking at, like, interviews and articles and stuff from today. But actually, Hugh Hefner kind of has a history of being progressive when it comes to race. He's obviously still rich white dude, and like in the 60s, he's not perfect, but he did have the first integrated variety show, which is kind of a big deal. Like his first episode, he had Nat King Cole and someone else, and they were just hanging out with white people like they should be. Like,
hold on. A Black person hanging out with a white person?
I know.
He's gone too far. He's gone
way too far. Honestly, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. It was banned in all southern states. Like, they would not air it on television. Even though everybody loves Nat King Cole, but, like, nope, they can't see him in the same room as a white person.
Yeah, they only see them as, like, an object or as a talent. I can imagine, like, a casserole lady watching TV, and then the program's happening. And the first thing she says is, huh, what do you know? They could talk to us. They're not so bad after all, honey. Honey, would you come look at this?
Thank you, Hugh Hefner, for solving segregation.
I swear to God, he fixed racism. I haven't experienced a lick of racism in my life because of him. Thank you, Hugh Hefner.
I mean, so this publication itself, I really don't feel like it endeavors to be outwardly racist. I'm actually surprised by the lack of faux pas that a 1960s publication written by and for a white man has. It's not to say that they did a lot to advance civil rights at the time, but honestly, they didn't do too much in the way of negating it.
I think they did a lot compared to most people, especially other companies. I mean, southern states were banning the publication of a white dude and a white dude talking, hanging out with each other. So I think they did an all right. I feel like they did a lot in terms of like pop culture and like media. Honestly, it probably has the biggest influence on people as a whole. I think pop culture and media influences people the most. Like if you watch too much Larry the Cable Guy, you might grow up to be racist, you know? But if you watch Dave Chappelle, you might grow up to be a wonderful human like me.
Yeah, definition of a wonderful human. Thank you for existing.
I am, of course, that's what I'm here for.
The general attitude of this magazine pushes towards that of like promoting racial equality, but acknowledging that it doesn't currently exist. So there's, of course, plenty more that should have been said about the conversations that were happening at the time, especially at such a pivotal cultural point that was like weeks away from the March on Selma. But what? I don't have any justification. They didn't do enough. They could have done more. They should have done better.
This is you just trying to like think of things. But I swear to God, they did something. They did something else.
Can you tell I have a crush on Hugh Hefner? Is it obvious?
Okay, that's just like not even needed because everybody has a crush on him. Like Dead said, when I was a kid, I always thought he was the biggest pimp in the world.
I mean, he was, literally.
Yeah, it was huge. It was so cool. And to be fair, I never knew he was like that cool of a guy, like that progressive of a person. And I'm sure he's done some bad things, but so have I. So I'm just going to ignore those red flags. But as a kid, I was like, man, Hugh Hefner is so cool. I had a crush on him.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, he does more than other people do. I will give him that amount of credit, but like the rest of it, you know, it could have been better. It should have been better. But Playboy, they do profess to be, quote, surely, if stumblingly, moving towards integration. One thing I thought was interesting, it's Playboy submits that it is agreed that the last barrier between the races to fall in this country will be the majority hostility towards interracial sex relations. So that's like the most clear statement that they had about integration, just basically saying like all of equality is going to come before we accept interracial sex relations.
Yes, 100%. I think that's probably the most true, to be fair. I think, I mean, and interracial kids still get, hate crimes, that they still have so many problems to deal with. But I think interracial marriage and just relationships is an amazing thing, because you could also learn so much from, somebody of color, just like a person of color could learn so much about a white person. Like, you know, they could learn how to make a casserole. You wouldn't have learned that with my tia. I think interracial kids and marriages are probably the strongest thing that would lead us to equality, because eventually we're all just going to be a mixture of one another.
I agree that that would definitely bring us closer to equality. But like, do you think that that's the last thing that's going to happen before equality happens? Like, do you think, you know, police brutality will end, incarceration will end, we will have truly equal voting rights before we'll have interracial sex relations?
As far as I know, I feel like it'll be closer, or interracial marriages will happen before cops, because cops become, like, you know,
like decent, like, human beings.
Yeah, decent human beings. If you give any person that much power, they're eventually gonna abuse it. And you know, politics is run by old white men for the most part, so those photos are not going to change.
Yeah, no, see, that's what I'm saying is, like, I feel like we will have interracial sex relations, which we already do have, like, prior to we'll have anything else. But they're saying, like, that's the absolute last thing to happen. So
okay.
For me, what I think is interesting is, like, this is 1965 when it's published, and they're like, oh, the last thing that's going to happen is, like, biracial couples.
But yeah, like end game and things. We'll definitely, the interracial thing will happen first. But I don't know if it'll be, like, the end. I don't know if, like, you know, as soon as everybody has an interracial kid, like, we all hold hands. Yeah, we all have you ever seen, I think it's, like, in kids, like, textbooks, and it's, like, a bunch of little kids holding hands.
Different colors around the world.
Yeah, and around the world, that's as soon as the last part, like, the last couple in the world has an interracial kid, that's just going to be us holding hands. Yeah, it's definitely not endgame, but it's a huge, I think interracial marriages are a huge push. And that's not to say that you should be actively looking for somebody who's not your same race. I mean, I'm constantly looking for white women, but that's only because I want papers. I want citizenship. That's the only reason. And I also don't want to get stopped by the police.
Well, the good news is you are actually going to further equality. So thank you.
Exactly. Even though I'm being selfish, I only want it for myself, because I don't want to get shot by the cops. I don't want to get stopped by the cops, and I want to be a U.S. citizen. So even though I am doing it for myself, I'm also doing it for the greater good of the world.
I think in terms of, like, saying that interracial sex relations are going to be, like, the last thing to happen, I think that hindsight is kind of 2020. Like, this is 1965 when it's published, and by 1967, like, literally 2 years later, they had made interracial relationships legal. So interesting that they were, like, actually illegal at the time of this publication, but they were legalized pretty quickly after, and you know, I don't think that they are necessarily, like, the most prevalent, but, like, obviously so much more now than they were in 1965. Yeah, so I think 100%. You know, probably, like you said, maybe police brutality.
That's not gonna happen anytime soon, I can tell you that right now.
It would be cool if people
in power weren't such scumbags, you know. That'd be nice, but we're just asking for too much at this point.
I know, you're right.
We're asking for way too much. Hey, can you stop killing us? No? Oh, okay, that's fine. Sorry for asking. I'm sorry.
So just on the topic of race and sex, there's this one article, story? It's fiction. There's this one piece of fiction in this issue called A Clowny Night in the Red-Eyed World. And it's written by this dude. It's basically this story of, like, this guy who, like, doesn't like this woman. and like goes over to her place to like sleep with her, and then she turns out to be like super racist. And he's like, oh, never mind, maybe I don't want to sleep with you. But then he's a considerate king, so he just goes through with it anyway. But the whole article, I really think the whole reason this dude like wrote it was basically just to use it as an excuse to like make the woman say every racial slur that has ever been created. I mean, she basically craps on like Jewish people, Catholic people, Blacks, Mexicans, you name it. Like, there is a racial slur in this article or piece of fiction.
Yeah, 100%. That's definitely why he did it. I'm sure, like, as he was asking her, he was like, wait, what was that one again? I haven't heard that one before. That one's good.
Honestly, so what I think we're going to do now is I'm going to have you read all of them aloud on air.
Okay, cool. Wait, are we taking another take? Because I did it like 3 times in a row, and I feel like I just know them by memory now. I could just start right now.
So as much as I can say about like Playboy kind of advancing, not advancing, but at least doing something for racial equality, I mean, this article really just undoes all of that work.
I don't know. He was having sex with a racist girl. That sounds like a king to me.
Yeah, he was taking the hit for the rest of us.
Yeah, so he was taking the hit for me. Appreciate you, king. Oh, man, thank you so much, dude. You are so considerate.
How much does this remind you of your sex life?
I do it all the time. And honestly, every time I have sex with a white woman, I think to myself, my grandfather must be so proud of me right now. Came here illegally as an immigrant, and I am having sex with somebody who stole our land. My grandfather is rolling in his grave. So happy. That's what I'm here for. I am that guy. So when I hear a girl, a white woman, just being racist, I'm like, that's the one. That's the one I love. And just go for him.
Speaking of your grandfather, I think you're going to like this next article we're going to talk about. This is the piece that Shel Silverstein has to contribute to this issue. It's called Silverstein in Mexico, and it's basically a bunch of cartoons and some pictures of his time south of the border. So as I'm sure you can guess, it is super PC, totally unproblematic.
And this guy is an old white man, right?
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. So how does he identify the Mexicans? Like, how do we know who's a Mexican and who's not the Mexican? I just want to know.
I will give you exactly one guess. Although
sombrero, wow.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you could play a drinking game with your margarita that you've got there, take a sip for every sombrero that's in this article.
Wait, no, hold on. You're also missing out on another Mexican stereotype, and that is that we're all alcoholics. And that would mean that I already finished my alcohol. I'm done with it. I finished it so quick because I'm Mexican and I'm an alcoholic.
Seems like Shel Silverstein would tend to agree with you. I think I see the word tequila like 4 times on this one page. I mean, really, this whole thing is just, it's just rife with stereotypes. It's literally, it's all sombreros, tequila, him sleeping with Mexican women and then complaining about STDs. He's so progressive.
It's literally just Trump. It's literally just Trump saying that we're not sending our best people over here. Which, he's probably not wrong because I came here illegally, so I don't know.
I'd much rather be like this guy in the cartoon, like just chilling, drinking beer on the sidewalk. That sounds...
Yeah, having a little siesta.
Oh, yes. He's got plenty to say about siestas here. There's this little cartoon of him talking to this guy. And the guy's dressed up in a nice suit. And he's like, you see, you Americans have a stereotype concept of Mexicans. You picture us as lazy peons and big sombreros living in adobe huts. But there is a modern Mexican, an educated, urbane, enterprising... Well, I'd explain more, but it's time for my siesta.
You know what's the worst part about that? Is that he was so close. He was so close to, like, putting a good message. he just screwed it up at the end. And the worst part is, it's not even, like, I feel like it's not funny because it's not accurate. Because I've never heard a Mexican ever say siesta in your life. My family is as Mexican as it gets. We're all illegal. And we have never said the word siesta, ever. The first time I heard the word siesta was from a white person.
You don't spend like all of your free time taking siestas.
Sometimes my mom calls me and she's like, hey, mijo, ¿qué estás haciendo? And I'm like, oh, ma, me estoy tomando una siesta. And then she's like, wow, I'm so happy from our heritage.
And you say that right after finishing a beer.
I say that right after finishing
una
a beer.
Una cerveza.
Yeah, una cerveza. And after putting my sombrero on my desk and just, you know, getting ready for my siesta.
Man, you and Shell would get along so well. Seems like he had a great time here, minus all of the STDs.
Well, I do want to mention this because I saw this online like not too long ago, and that's like a lot of people, and it's mainly white people being offended for us. They'll be like, oh man, like stop appropriating Mexican culture and stuff like that. But I think it's so cool when like things like, and it's not necessarily like appropriating, but like appreciating or something like that. Because not too long ago, a few years ago, there was a new game that came out, Super Mario Odyssey. It was a Mario game, and then there's like a level where they're like in the desert, and there's like a bunch of like skeletons, like Dia de los Muertos type of people. And they have sombreros and ponchos, and I think it's so cool. That's my favorite part of the whole game. And I've seen so many people being like, oh, that's racist. You're appropriating the culture. And I was like, it's not racist. They didn't call me a beaner or anything like that. It's fun. I like it. It's so cool. It's my favorite outfit in the whole game. The whole game I spent it with a sombrero and a poncho. I think it's so cool. And I hate when other people are trying to like cancel things that we don't want to get canceled. Keep doing it. Keep putting sombreros on things. As long as it's not racist, like this guy right here was making it. As long as you're just making it cool, then go for it. You know, if you're being racist, that's a whole different thing. But if it's like if I saw like a Garfield comic and he just has a sombrero, I think that'd be so cool. My favorite things ever like in life has been when like Mexican culture has been presented in media. I love it so much. I love it to death.
Does this Playboy count as media that you like to be represented then?
Oh yeah, definitely that one for sure. That's my favorite one actually.
To be fair, I would love to see you caricatured in his style.
Yeah. Oh, I could go to my closet right now and pick out some of my ponchos and my sombreros if you want me to wear.
All right, you keep those on you, huh?
Of course, I stay strapped.
So I think we covered race. I think it's done. I think we talked about everything.
Yeah, 100%. Racism is solved thanks to us.
I'm gonna go make a casserole.
Yeah, and I'm gonna go take a siesta.
Thanks for joining me today. Is there anything that you want to plug? Any social media?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. You can follow me on Instagram at Aries Hinojosa. I'll let you figure out how to spell that. I'm not going to help you out. And you're welcome for having soft racism.
So today we talked briefly about race in the pages of this issue. And in the upcoming weeks, we'll cover sexuality, gender, the articles within the magazine itself. And so please tune back in. If you have any comments, if you want to tell me how your delicious Playboy margarita was, feel free to email playboyrevisited@gmail.com. As a fun little aside, if you want to listen to the playlist from this issue, you can find it on Spotify if you just search the name of the podcast and then the date of the issue. So if you search Playboy Revisited 0365, like March 1965, you'll be able to find a playlist. And this is all of the songs that they talk about in the issue itself. So very jazzy, very fun. But yeah, thanks for joining us today. Come back next week. Can't wait to see you again. Bye.